unless the government would admit to conspiracy. The only possible law enforcement action had expired on November 24, 1963, when Jack Ruby gunned down Lee Harvey Oswald, the government's only suspect. Moreover, the analyses had been done as part of an investigation the FBI made for the Warren Commission. Where the assassination was concerned, neither the FBI nor the Warren Commission had law enforcement powers. Indeed, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover testified before the Warren Commission that his agency had no jurisdiction to investigate the crime. The Warren Commission did have authority to investigate the assassination, but not for the purpose of prosecuting law violators. Its purpose was to establish the truth and report it to the president. Now, in spite of the fact that it had no legal means for, no legal basis for resisting Lazar and Weisberg's suit, the government did so, and not only did they attempt to prevent disclosure of the spectrographic evidence, but they went through a number of very strange legal maneuvers in order to do this. First of all, when the case was to be heard, the government filed an affidavit by an FBI agent named Marion Williams, which was regarded as a key piece of evidence. Now, the affidavit was filed at the last possible minute. It was filed so late that it did not give Jim Lazar, Weisberg's counsel, time to respond to it, and it was a key piece of evidence. This is worth noting because the affidavit itself was dated 2.5 months before it was filed, so that obviously they could have allowed Jim Lazar, Weisberg's counsel, to go over this 2.5 months in advance. They held this up to the very last minute, and the judge allowed them to do that. Now, in Whitewash Volume 4, the significance of the affidavit, again, by an FBI agent named Marion Williams, W-I-L-L-I-M-S, is covered as follows. Again, this from Whitewash Volume 4. The Williams affidavit was an absurd document. It contained at least one provably false statement, mischaracterized Weisberg's request for the results obtained from the spectrographic tests as a request for the release of raw data, unquote, and recited a catalog of speculative horrors which Williams said might ensue court-ordered release of the analyses. Quote, it could lead, for example, to exposure of confidential informants, the disclosure out of context of the names of suspected persons on whom criminal justice action is not yet complete, possible blackmail, and in general, do irreparable harm. And Jim Lazar goes on to comment here. The Williams affidavit was clearly preposterous. There is no way that releasing the spectrographic results could lead to the exposure of confidential informants or any of the other harms Williams imagined. Now, a hearing was set before the judge on this case. The government's attorney, a man named Robert Werdig, W-E-R-D-I-G, showed up very late for the hearing. The judge then announced that he was going to have to leave early because he had an appointment to keep. The judge's name, by the way, is John Sirica. Now, John Sirica is old Maximum John, the judge for the original Watergate case that in which the Watergate burglars were tried, and his steadfastness in pursuing that case is often credited with having, along with James McCord's letter, with having broken the Watergate case. So pay close attention to his actions here. Now, still later, the government's attorney, in arguing to prevent disclosure of the spectrographic evidence, argued basically that the Attorney General of the United States had determined that national interest would be harmed by the release. Now, remember that national security or national interest was specifically exempted by Congress as a reason for withholding evidence, so that has no merit here whatsoever. In addition, there's no indication that the Attorney General ever made any such finding. Now, perhaps one of the most amazing things connected with this legal maneuvering around the release of the spectro evidence concerns Robert Werdig's argument when pressed by Lazar to cite a reason why, cite what law was being enforced by the FBI performing the test for the Warren Commission, remember, part of the executive branch. The attorney says, well, it just has to be some law, quote, natural or human, unquote. Not much of a legal argument. Imagine if you're a student, if you did not hand in your term paper to your professor on time, and when asked why you did not, you said, well, it just has to be some reason, natural or human. Or imagine if you're at work and you're asked by your boss why you didn't do something, and you gave the excuse, there has to be some law, quote, natural or human, unquote. Well, you can anticipate the response. So this was the nature of the government's argument here, and the resolution of this particular case, and the government's statement that the Attorney General had determined that release would hurt the country is covered by Jim Lazar as follows, again from Whitewash Volume 4. Talking about government attorney Werdig here, Robert Werdig. Werdig had another and dirtier trick up his sleeve, one which also helped divert attention from the spurious Williams affidavit. He told Judge Sirica that, quote, "In this instance, the Attorney General of the United States has determined that it is not in the national interest to divulge these spectrographic analyses. Because Congress had expressly rejected national interest," unquote, as a grounds for withholding information, Werdig's assertion was at best irrelevant and irresponsible. I now believe that it was worse than that. I believe that no Attorney General has ever made any such determination. No such determination has been produced. In a latter case, the government refused to answer an interrogatory I addressed to it about this, quote, determination, unquote. All of this also detracted from the failure of the Department of Justice to justify its legal position. For example, when pressed to say what law was being enforced by the FBI's investigation for the non-law enforcing Warren Commission, Werdig could do no better than to argue that there just had to be some law, quote, natural or human, unquote. At the conclusion of oral argument, Judge Sirica, ruling from the bench, granted the government's motion to dismiss. He delivered no opinion and made no findings of fact. So, apparently, Judge Sirica felt that some law, natural or human, was a good enough excuse for the executive branch of the government to be granted temporary law enforcement powers. However, it's worth noting that eventually the case was overturned on appeal, and it's the spectrographic evidence upon release confirmed what everybody already knew, which was that the single bullet theory was impossible.
That's right. As a matter of fact, we presented some of that spectrographic evidence and the FBI's response to it and the way they dealt with it in the second part of the program, or the second part of the series. Another comment that, of course, has to be made at this point is when we're talking about that particular Justice Department, I think it also has to be mentioned that the Attorney General at that time, who, whether he did or did not affirm that the national security would be jeopardized, who was in charge of that Justice Department, was, of course, John Mitchell. Who I think in 1969, about a year before this happened, was quoted as saying, "This country is going so far to the right you won't recognize it." John Mitchell himself, the chief law enforcement officer of the entire country, who as Attorney General was responsible for, of course, the secret slush fund, bribing of officials, the setting in motion of a chain of events to literally intimidate and lie about other candidates and a variety of other just absolutely sickening, even on the surface, just sickening illegal activities. This was the Justice Department that was fighting to look for some law, natural or human, to deny the spectrographic evidence to Weisberg and Lazar.
By the way, that same Justice Department, Jim Garrison has taken a bad rap from popular American history as having been sort of a publicity seeker, and he was defamed as a result of having been indicted. Now, he was indicted for allegedly skimming profits from pinball machines. He was acquitted of this charge, and the witnesses against him were all basically mafiosi working for Carlos Marcello, who was capo mafioso for New Orleans, and also was one of the prime mafia suspects in the mafia angle of the assassination of President Kennedy. And this suit was brought, was filed under Jim Garrison's Justice, or under John Mitchell's Justice Department, rather.
Indeed.
Detail I forgot to mention when talking about Judge Sirica was that he had campaigned for Richard Nixon in both of his successful presidential campaigns and had contributed money as well.
That's right. So, an interesting character who crops up again. Now what we're going to talk about, and somebody that we have mentioned from time to time on both One Step Beyond and Dave's show Hard Rain, is a gentleman by the name of Leon Jaworski, whose name has cropped up in several situations, not only Watergate, which we're going to talk about, and the Kennedy assassination, which we're going to talk about, but of course, more recently in the CoreaGate scandal and other things of that ilk.
And in the very beginning of his career, he also was involved with the Nuremberg hearings. So Mr. Jaworski has been there many times when the legal worm has turned, historically speaking. Okay, now, an agreement between the presidency and Congress, between President Nixon and Congress, a special prosecutor was set up in order to investigate and prosecute any crimes performed in connection with the Watergate affair. Now, the initial person agreed upon by both Congress and Richard Nixon was a man named Archibald Cox. Now, Archibald Cox was President Kennedy's Solicitor General, and in that capacity had been consulted by President Kennedy consulted by Kennedy with regard to a number of different matters, including the possible arrest of right-winger General Edwin Walker for stirring up trouble when the University of Mississippi was being desegregated in 1962. Worth noting because Edwin Walker crops up in connection with Lee Harvey Oswald and other people in connection with the investigation. If you'd like to know about that, we'll talk about that in the phone-in section of the program because we've discussed it before and time marches on. Now, Archibald Cox was very doggedly pursuing the White House tapes, the transcripts of the tapes that we referred to in the portion of the program just concluded. Now, as I mentioned, a White House aide, Alexander Butterfield, had revealed the existence of the White House taping system and that thereby all Nixon conversations, all conversations in the White House had been taped. Now, Archibald Cox was pursuing the release of some of these transcripts in order to investigate possible criminal wrongdoing in connection with the Watergate affair, and apparently it was a little too diligent in his pursuit of these tapes. Nixon attempted to block release of the tapes by claiming executive privilege, and when Archibald Cox would not buy that, in what became known as the Saturday Night Massacre, Richard Nixon fired Archibald Cox and several Justice Department aides who refused to effect the firing of Archibald Cox, including his own attorney general, and basically Richard Nixon fired the congressionally appointed special prosecutor. Now, the man that Richard Nixon named as a successor to Archibald Cox was Leon Jaworski. He was approved by Congress. Now, Leon Jaworski had cropped up in connection with the assassination of President Kennedy. Basically, Jaworski was not only a special Warren Commission counsel, but he was also special counsel to something called the Texas Court of Inquiry. Now, what this was an abortive body set up by then-Texas Attorney General Wagner Carr, last name C-A-R-R, to investigate the assassination of President Kennedy for the state of Texas. That investigation never got very far, and Leon Jaworski was named as a special counsel to the Texas Court of Inquiry. And as a special counsel to the Warren Commission, he was in charge of investigating the allegations that Lee Harvey Oswald had been affiliated with either the FBI or the CIA. And picking a man like Leon Jaworski to investigate something like that is very interesting in light of his background.
Indeed, and we're going to read a brief section here again from a book that we just used a few moments ago, Whitewash Volume 4 by Harold Weisberg, Legal Analysis by Jim Lazar. This is the people that we were talking about in regards to the spectro evidence blocked by the Nixon Justice Department. And here Weisberg is talking about Leon Jaworski and his role in the Kennedy assassination. And later on, he also mentions the Watergate affair. And he says, one of the Texas officials, the also respected and wealthy partner in a prestigious Houston law firm, Special Counsel Leon Jaworski, was Rankin's accomplice. And that's J. Lee Rankin, who is a...
J. Lee Rankin. You got it right.
Okay.
J. Lee Rankin.
All right. As shown by what I, meaning Weisberg, what I used to illustrate the transcript's reference to him, Jaworski was Nixon's second selectee as special Watergate prosecutor, as Dave mentioned, following the fired Archibald Cox. In that role, his record is not inconsistent with his working as the actual boss of the aborted Texas Court of Inquiry. Jaworski should never have accepted his Court of Inquiry post, as he should never have become special prosecutor, because he had a conflict of interest. He had been an active participant in illegal CIA activity, in secret funding of secret CIA fronts domestically. The first suggestion of Oswald as a federal agent, and it was almost immediate, gave Jaworski a conflict he could not resolve. With the abundant reporting of CIA involvement in the Watergate, he faced and ignored the same conflict. Jaworski was and remained on the M.D. Anderson Fund, publicly exposed as a CIA front in the 1967 CIA scandal centering around the National Student Association, which had been financed and seduced by the CIA. One of the abundant sources is a chapter of The Espionage Establishment, an expose of CIA by David Weiss in collaboration with Thomas Ross. So here's Leon Jaworski, who keeps cropping up and essentially is also, and it's important to note, not only show up, but he's been presented by the press to the people of America as the white knight of the American legal system, who comes rushing into these situations where there are, you know, possibilities of government complacence in wrongdoing, like Koreagate, like Watergate, like the Kennedy assassination, although that was being played down very heavily, but it was certainly an element from the very beginning. Leon Jaworski comes riding in on his white steed, the impartial and totally unblemishable patron saint of the legal establishment. Well, indeed, what we find out that all along, Leon Jaworski was fronting the MD Anderson Fund, a major CIA front, and a group that was used domestically by the CIA to basically infiltrate and overthrow a whole bunch of student and activist organizations and things of that nature.
Two quick details in connection with that. Interestingly enough, Judge Sarah Hughes, who administered LBJ's oath of office, was the head of another one of these domestic CIA fronts. And now, Leon Jaworski was also named as Koreagate special prosecutor. One of the things that came out in the course of the Koreagate hearings was that Tongzin Park had set up the Moonies as a front for the Korean CIA, which is, of course, very closely affiliated with our CIA. It's interesting because the Moonies were very active on behalf of President Nixon during Watergate. Okay, now Leon Jaworski, as special counsel not only to the Texas Court of Inquiry, but also as special counsel to the Warren Commission, was one of just a handful of people who were present on June 7th, 1964 in Dallas, Texas, when basically Jack Ruby, the slayer of Lee Harvey Oswald, was interviewed by the Warren Commission. Now, before reading you some portions of that interview, first of all, I'd like to read you the cast of characters that was present at this interview. Now, I'm reading now from a book called Who is Jack Ruby? This is authored by a man named Seth Cantor, last name K-A-N-T-O-R, and it's published in hardcover by Everest House and is copyrighted 1978. Now, when Jack Ruby was interviewed by the Warren Commission on June 7th, 1964, there were the following people present. First of all, there was Earl Warren, chairman of the Warren Commission and Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. There was also Gerald Ford. Now, Gerald Ford at that time was House Minority Leader. He was the leader of the minority party in the House of Representatives. And he was appointed to the Warren Commission at the instigation of Richard Nixon. Now, Gerald Ford was one of the people present at this Jack Ruby interview. Now, keep in mind that Gerald Ford, after Vice President Agnew was forced from office by a scandal, then House Minority Leader Gerald Ford was named by Richard Nixon as his vice president. Eventually, when Nixon himself was forced from office, Gerald Ford became president of the United States. And within a month after Nixon resigned, Gerald Ford pardoned Richard Nixon for any crimes he may have committed in connection with Watergate. Now, keep in mind that it was at Nixon's instigation that Ford became a Warren Commission member. And Gerald Ford is present at this interview on June 7th, 1964.
Let me make one important clarification from memory. Again, this could be checked, but I believe that what Gerald Ford pardoned Richard Nixon for was any crimes he might have committed while president, which is a much broader sort of basis of things to work with in terms of things we've been talking about tonight and other things, so not just Watergate.
All righty. Now, in addition to Earl Warren and Gerald Ford, present at this particular interview on June 7th, 64, There were two attorneys reading here now from Who Was Jack Ruby by Seth Cantor. Besides the commission members Warren and Ford, there were the commission counsel, Rankin, Joseph A. Ball, and Arlen Specter. Arlen Specter now, by the way, is a senator from Pennsylvania and is sitting on the Senate Judiciary Committee. There were two attorneys, Leon Jaworski and Robert G. Story, representing the official Texas state inquiry into the Kennedy assassination, which was directed by Texas Attorney General Wagner Carr, and which was being muzzled by authorities in Washington. There was Elmer W. Moore, a Secret Service agent, Jim Bowie, an assistant Dallas district attorney, Sheriff Decker, and Tannehill. Now, Joe Tannehill, last name T-O-N-A-H-I-L-L, was Jack Ruby's defense attorney. A number of other people had worked on his defense, including Melvin Belli. Now, Joe Tannehill, keep in mind, he's the man who was defending Jack Ruby, is an interesting person. Reading once again now about Joe Tannehill's background, well, this once again from Who Was Jack Ruby by Seth Cantor. Belli gave the impression of an international liberal, an anathema in a Dallas court of law. But Tannehill had the cornpone in him, and his office was a short piece east through the rugged East Texas pines and swamps from Martin Dees Jr. State Park, named after the late communist hunting chairman of what was once the House Un-American Activities Committee on Capitol Hill. Tannehill himself was the son-in-law of the extremely conservative Virginia Congressman Judge Howard W. Smith, the chairman of the House Rules Committee, who had blocked or tried to block almost every piece of progressive Kennedy administration legislation from getting to the House floor for debate. Okay, so Jack Ruby's defense attorney is the son-in-law of one of President Kennedy's fiercest congressional opponents. Keep that in mind, because Tannehill is going to figure very prominently in the verbal sparring, which we're about to delve into. Now, keep in mind, this is the interview, what I'm about to be reading, what I'm about to read to you here, is the actual transcript of the interview that Jack Ruby had with the Warren Commission. Now, the following people, the preceding people, rather, were present. Now, keep in mind, Leon Jaworski, connected with CIA. He was Watergate special prosecutor. Keep in mind, Gerald Ford, who pardoned Richard Nixon. All of these people are present here. Now,
I was just going to mention one other thing to bear in mind here, as far as Jack Ruby. Now, we're talking about a man, again, if you some of you missed some of the earlier shows and you're not familiar, Jack Ruby, who shot Lee Harvey Oswald ostensibly, and again, this is the Warren Commission's theory, or the Warren Commission's reason, that has been handed around and is still being used by Life Magazine, Time, Inc., and these people, as Ruby's justification, was essentially that Jack Ruby felt sorry for the grieving widow of President Kennedy, who would have to come back to Dallas and answer questions. And then another story that he supposedly thought he would be a big man and that they would let him off and say, well, Jack, you shouldn't have done it, but we're not really that mad with you. Here, go ahead, now be famous, and people will come by and shake your hand. Well, in reality, as we've mentioned before, and this is just briefly to bring you folks back up to date, Jack Ruby had a lifelong history of ties to the mafia, not only starting way back in the very early days in Chicago when he was a runner for the Capone mob, going straight on up to Havana, Cuba, where he was involved with the Lansky Syndicate and their involvement with the Batista government, who essentially let the mafia run free in Cuba, doing just what they please, raking in millions of dollars from the casinos. So Jack Ruby is a strong gangster connection, with strong connections to Cuba, to pre-Castro Cuba, and to a variety of mobsters who are known to be anti-Kennedy and very violently anti-Castro. So this is the man who, just out of altruism and a desire to save the grieving widow of President Kennedy, a man by all rights Jack Ruby should loathe, this is the man who supposedly shot Lee Harvey Oswald for these sort of patently useless reasons. And this is the man who is being interviewed by the Warren Commission with all these people that Dave has mentioned, Jaworski and Ford, et al., and Tannehill, his own lawyer, in the Dallas cell.
Okay, now I'm going to be reading some excerpts here from a book called The Yankee and Cowboy War that we've read from before on this program. The Yankee and Cowboy War was authored by Carl Oglesby, O-G-L-E-S-B-Y, published in softcover by Berkeley Medallion Books in 1976. Now, in this book and in many other books on the Kennedy assassination, there are some excerpts here published from Volume 5 of the 26 volumes of Warren Commission Testimony and Exhibits. And the excerpts I'm going to be reading you here, come from Volume 5, pages 181 through 212. Now, they're reprinted in Yankee and Cowboy War, as they have been in many books, but these excerpts here are actually from Volume 5 of the Warren Commission Testimony and Exhibits, page 181 through 212. And the excerpts that I'm going to be reading you here were first made public in August of 1964 by What's My Line columnist and gossip columnist Dorothy Kilgallen, What's My Line panelist and columnist Dorothy Kilgallen, who herself died under very strange circumstances shortly thereafter. We talked about her last week. Okay, keep in mind, all of the people who were present at Jack Ruby's interview with the Warren Commission. This is the actual text, once again, from Volume 5, 181 through 212. 1. This is another man on my staff, Mr. Spector. Would you mind if he came in? Chief Justice Warren introduced the men around the room. Ruby. Is there any way to get me to Washington? Warren. I beg your pardon? Ruby. Is there any way of you getting me to Washington? Warren. I don't know of any. I will be glad to talk to your counsel about what the situation is, Mr. Ruby, when we get an opportunity to talk. Ruby has been intermittently begging a chance to talk to Warren alone. Ruby. By the way, the parenthetical interjections here are stuck in by Oglesby. They're not in the actual text. Ruby. I don't think I will get a fair representation with my counsel, Joe Tannehill. I don't think so. I would like to request that I go to Washington and you take all the tests that I have to take. It is very important. Tannehill. Jack, will you tell him why you don't think you will get a fair representation? Ruby. Because I've been over this for the longest time to get the lie detector test. Somebody has been holding it back from me. Warren. Mr. Ruby, I might say to you that the lateness of this thing is not due to your counsel. It was our own delay due to the pressures we had on us at the time. And still later, Ruby, gentlemen, unless you get me to Washington, you can't get a fair shake out of me. If you understand my way of talking, you have got to bring me to Washington to get the tests. Do I sound dramatic? Off the beam? Warren. No, you were speaking very, very rationally. And I am really surprised that you can remember as much as you have remembered up to the present time. You have given it to us in great detail. Ruby, unless you can get me to Washington, and I'm not a crackpot, I have all my senses, I don't want to evade any crime I am guilty of, but, Mr. Moore, have I spoken this way before when we talked? Moore, yes. Elmer W. Moore, by the way, is a Secret Service agent. Ruby, unless you get me to Washington immediately, I'm afraid after what Mr. Tannehill has written there... Well, it is too bad, Chief Warren, that you didn't get me to your headquarters 6 months ago. And still later. Ruby, are you staying overnight here, Chief Warren? Warren, no, I have to be back because we have an early session of court tomorrow morning. Ruby, is there any way of getting the polygraph here? Decker. J.E. Bill Decker, by the way, is the Dallas County Sheriff. He's also present here. Decker, may I make a suggestion? Jack, listen. You and I have had a lot of dealings. Do you want my officers removed from the room while you talk to this commission? Ruby, that wouldn't prove any truth. Decker, these people came several thousand miles to interview you. You have wanted to tell me your story, and I have refused to let you tell me. Now, be a man with a bunch of men that have come a long way to give an opportunity to Ruby. I wish the president were here right now. It is a terrible ordeal, I'll tell you that. Bill, will you do that for me that you asked a minute ago? You said you wanted to leave the room. Decker, I will have everyone leave the room, including myself, if you want to talk about it. You name it, and out we will go. Ruby, all right. Decker, you want all of us outside? Ruby, yes. Decker, I will leave Tannehill and Moore. I'm not going to have Joe leave. Ruby, if you're not going to have Joe leave... Decker, Moore, his body is responsible to you. His body is responsible to you. Ruby, Bill, I am not accomplishing anything if they are here and Joe Tannehill is here. You ask me anybody I wanted out. Decker, Jack, this is your attorney. This is your lawyer. Ruby, he is not my lawyer. Gentlemen, if you want to hear any further testimony, you will have to get me to Washington soon, because it has something to do with you, Chief Warren. Do I sound sober enough to tell you this, Warren? Yes, go right ahead. Ruby, I want to tell the truth, and I can't tell it here. I can't tell it here. Does that make sense to you, Warren? Well, let's not talk about sense. But I really can't see why you can't tell this commission. Ruby, but this isn't the place for me to tell what I want to tell. Moore, the commission is looking into the entire matter, and you are part of it. Should be. Ruby, Chief Warren, your life is in danger in this city. Do you know that, Warren? No, I don't know that. If that is the thing that you don't want to talk about, you can tell me if you wish when this is all over, just between you and me. Ruby, no, I would like to talk to you in private. Warren, you may do that when you finish your story. You may tell me that phase of it. Ruby, I bet you haven't had a witness like me in your whole investigation. Is that correct? Warren, there are many witnesses whose memory has not been as good as yours. I tell you that honestly. Ruby, my reluctance to talk. You haven't had any witness in telling your story and finding so many problems. Warren, you have a greater problem than any witness we've had. Ruby, I have a lot of reasons for having those problems. Warren, I know that. And we want to respect your rights, whatever they may be. And I only want to hear what you are willing to tell us because I realize that you still have a great problem before you, and I'm not trying to press you. Ruby, when are you going back to Washington? Warren, I'm going back very shortly after we finish this hearing. I'm going to have some lunch. Ruby, can I make a statement? Warren, yes. Ruby, if you request me to go back to Washington with you right now, that couldn't be done, could it? Warren, no, it could not be done. It could not be done. There are a good many things involved in that, Mr. Ruby. Ruby, what are they? Warren, well, the public attention that it would attract and the people who would be around. We have no place for you to be safe when we take you out, and we are not law enforcement officers, and it's not our responsibility to go into anything of that kind, and certainly it couldn't be done on a moment's notice this way. Ruby, my life is in danger here. Not with my guilty plea of execution, i.e. not because of killing Oswald. Do I sound sober enough to you as I say this, Warren? You do. You sound entirely sober. Ruby, from the moment I started my testimony, have I sounded as though, with the exception of becoming emotional, haven't I sounded as though I made sense what I was speaking about, Warren? You have indeed. I understand everything you have said. If I haven't, it's my fault. Ruby, then I follow this up. I may not live tomorrow to give any further testimony. The reason why I add this to this, since you assure me that I have been making sense by then, I might be speaking sense by following what I have said, and the only thing I want to get out to the public, and I can't say it here, is with authenticity, with sincerity of the truth of everything and why my act was committed. But it can't be said here. It can be said, it's got to be said, amongst people of the highest authority that would give me the benefit of the doubt. And following that, immediately give me the lie detector test after I do make the statement. Chairman Warren, if you felt that your life was in danger at the moment, how would you feel? Wouldn't you be reluctant to go on speaking, even though you request me to do so? Warren, I think I might have some reluctance if I was in your position. Yes, I think I would. I think I would figure it out very carefully as to whether it would endanger me or not. If you think that anything that I am doing or anything that I am asking you is endangering you in any way, shape, or form, I want you to feel absolutely free to say that the interview is over. Ruby, what happens then? I didn't accomplish anything. Warren, no, nothing has been accomplished. Ruby, well, then you won't follow up with anything further? Warren, there wouldn't be anything to follow up if you hadn't completed your statement. Ruby, you said you have the power to do what you want to do. Is that correct? Warren, exactly. Ruby, without any limitations? Warren, within the purview of the executive order which established the commission, Ruby, but you don't have a right to take a prisoner back with you when you want to? Warren, no. We have the power to subpoena witnesses to Washington if we want to do it. But we have taken the testimony of 200 or 300 people, I would imagine, here in Dallas without going to Washington. Ruby, yes, but those people aren't Jack Ruby. Warren, no, they weren't. Ruby, they weren't. Warren, now I want you to feel that we are not here to take any advantage of you, because I know that you are in a delicate position. And unless you would indicate it not only through your letters, but also through your sister, who wrote a letter addressed either to me or to Mr. Rankin saying you wanted to testify before the commission, unless she had told us that, I wouldn't have bothered you. Ruby, the thing is that with your power that you have, Chief Justice Warren, and all these gentlemen, too much time has gone by for me to give you any benefit of what I may say now. And still later. Rankin, it isn't entirely clear how you feel that your family and you yourself are threatened by your telling what you have to the commission. How do you come to the conclusion that they might be killed? Will you tell us a little bit more about that, if you can, Ruby? Well, assuming that, as I stated before, some persons are accusing me falsely of being part of the plot, naturally, in all the time from over 6 months ago, my family has been so interested in helping me. Rankin, by that you mean a party to the plot of Oswald? Ruby, that I was a party to a plot to silence Oswald. Warren, Mr. Ruby, I think you are entitled to a statement to this effect because you have been frank with us and you have told us your story. I think I can say to you that there has been no witness before this commission out of the hundreds we have questioned who has claimed to have any personal knowledge that you were a party to any conspiracy to kill our president. Ruby, yes, but you don't know this area here. Warren, well, I will make this additional statement to you, that if any witness should testify before the commission that you were, to their knowledge, a party to any conspiracy to assassinate the president, I assure you that we will give you the opportunity to deny it and to take any test that you may so desire to disprove it. Ruby, and I wish that our beloved President Lyndon Johnson would have delved deeper into the situation. Hear me. Not to accept just circumstantial facts about my guilt or innocence, and would have questioned to find out the truth about me before he relinquished certain powers to these certain people. Consequently, a whole new form of government is going to take over our country, and I know I won't live to see you another time. Do I sound sort of screwing in telling you these things, Warren? No, I think that is what you believe, or you wouldn't tell it under oath, Ruby. But it is a very serious situation. I guess it's too late to stop it, isn't it? And still later. Ford, are there any questions that ought to be asked to help clarify the situation that you described? Ruby, there is only one thing. If you don't get me back to Washington tonight to give me a chance to prove to the president that I am not guilty, then you will see the most tragic. Then you will see the most tragic thing that will ever happen. And still later, Ruby, now maybe something can be saved. It may not be too late, whatever happens, if our President Lyndon Johnson knew the truth from me. But if I am eliminated, there won't be any way of knowing. Right now, when I leave your presence now, I am the only one that can bring out the truth to our president who believes in righteousness and justice. But he has been told, I am certain, that I was part of a plot to assassinate the president. I know, your hands are tied, you are helpless. Warren. Mr. Ruby, I think I can say this to you, that if he has been told any such thing, there is no indication of any kind that he believes it. Ruby, I'm sorry, Chief Justice Warren. I thought I would be very effective in telling you what I have said here, but in all fairness to everyone, maybe all I want to do is to beg that if they found out I was telling the truth, maybe they can succeed in what their motives are, but maybe my people won't be tortured and mutilated. Warren. Well, you may be sure that my president and his whole commission will do anything that is necessary to see that your people are not tortured. Ruby, no. Warren, you may be sure of that. Ruby, no. The only way you can do it is if he knows the truth, that I am telling the truth, and why I was down in that basement Sunday morning, and maybe some sense of decency will come out, and they can still fulfill their plan, as I stated before, without my people going through torture and mutilation. Warren, the president will know everything that you have said. Everything that you have said, Ruby. But I won't be around, Chief Justice. I won't be around to verify those things that you were going to tell the president. Tannehill, who never left the room. Who do you think is going to eliminate you, Jack? Ruby, I have been used for a purpose, and there will be a certain tragic occurrence happening if you don't take my testimony and somehow vindicate me so my people don't suffer because of what I've done. Warren, but we have taken your testimony. We have it here. It will be in permanent form for the President of the United States and for the Congress of the United States and for the courts of the United States and for the people of the entire world. It is there. It will be recorded for all to see. That is the purpose of our coming here today. We feel that you are entitled to have your story told. Ruby, you have lost me, though. You have lost me, Chief Justice Warren. Warren, lost you? In what sense? Ruby, I won't be around for you to come and question again. Warren, well, it is very hard for me to believe that. I am sure that everybody would want to protect you to the very limit. Ruby, all I want is a lie detector test, and you refuse to give it to me. Because as it stands now in the truth serum and any other penicillin, how do you pronounce it, whatever it is, and they will not give it to me because I want to tell the truth, and then I want to leave this world. Still later. Ruby, how are we going to communicate and so on? Warren, we will communicate directly with you. Ruby, you have a lost cause, Earl Warren. You don't stand a chance. They feel about you like they do about me, Chief Justice Warren. I shouldn't hurt your feelings in telling you that.
All right. And the first time I heard that, well, let me tell you, the same chills went up my spine that just went up now listening to that. Truly an amazing bit of testimony. The one thing that has to be asked is, do you really believe that man, Jack Ruby, wanted to get to Washington so badly to tell the President of the United States and under oath and under a lie detector test and with sodium pentothal if necessary that he had shot Lee Harvey Oswald so Jackie Kennedy wouldn't have to come back to Dallas?
Keep in mind, too, that the official Warren Commission version, now there are a number of different, there's the media version, there was the Texas Law Court decision on Jack Ruby that he was basically, they decided that they overturned his conviction on first-degree murder, and then there was the official Warren Commission thesis, which was that Jack Ruby suffered from a psychomotor epileptic disorder, which, under the strain of the moment, his tremendous grief at Kennedy's death just caused, just triggered a brief psychomotor epileptic episode in the basement there, which just caused him to kill Lee Harvey Oswald with a single shot. Keep in mind all of these things, and once again, his lawyer, Joe Tannehill, was the son-in-law of one of Kennedy's fiercest congressional opponents, which may account for some of his reluctance to deal with him.
Yes, and Jack Ruby's obvious nervousness about having Joe Tannehill in the room with him, and again, I think that just the whole aura of a man just terrified to death to talk frankly and just desperately trying to be taken somewhere to talk. And of course, none of this comes out in the Warren Commission report. None of this whatsoever. Jack Ruby is painted as being, as Dave put it, you know, psychomotor epileptic, alone, incidents of strange behavior, you know, a fluke, a chance of this and of that. And I think that just listening to that testimony will help you to make up your own mind as to whether that was the case or not.
Keep in mind that Special Prosecutor Jaworski, as well as ex-President Ford, heard exactly what you've heard, except they heard the real McCoy. Jaworski didn't have a speaking part in that thing, but he was there, and I'm told by Mae Brussel, who has cross-indexed this entire volume, that that the testimony that was made public is some of the more tame testimony. That it gets a lot heavier than that.
Yes, well, we've seen that pattern before, and we will undoubtedly see it again. Okay, we have a couple of last things we want to deal with very quickly here before we open up the phones. One of which we were not able to get the particular document that we wanted, but we are going to mention it anyway because in light of the Kennedy assassination, Watergate, which we're talking about right at the moment, it's rather interesting, and that is the death of Murray Chotiner.
Right. In January of 1973, as the Watergate case was just starting to really thicken, Murray Chotiner, who was an organized crime attorney, generally credited with having given Richard Nixon the boot in the pants which got him into politics in the first place, was killed in a very mysterious hit-and-run accident. And in his obituary, which I was hoping to be able to read to you this evening, we were going to have it on hand, but unfortunately, it has been unaccountably delayed in the mails, a copy of it, so hopefully we'll be able to read it to you maybe at the beginning of next week. Anyway, in his obituary in the San Francisco Chronicle in January of 73, Murray Chotiner says, you know, everybody knows that I helped boost Richard Nixon in got him into politics, but what people don't know is that I also gave the impetus to Earl Warren's political career. Worth noting in this context that Earl Warren has this reputation as a liberal. He was the fellow who has, I believe he was then governor of California, helped effect the concentration camp program for the internment of Japanese citizens during World War II. He also was vice presidential candidate on the Republican ticket under Dewey in 1948. So, also, by the way, the leading suspect in the unsolved murder of his own father. So his credentials as an upstanding citizen are at best dubious.
Something to be discussed, and no doubt something that will draw a great deal of response from out there. Anyway, wish we had that Chotiner obituary. We certainly seem to be reading a lot of obituaries on this show, don't we?
Hopefully we'll have it by next week. It should have been here today, but has not gotten here through the U.S. mails.
Okay, one last thing we're going to touch on. And again, the Watergate stuff alone, we could be elaborating on for hours and hours, but we're having to pick some high points here. One of my own, and again, this is spoken in a rather cynical way, one of my own favorite parts of the Watergate-Kennedy assassination connections is the question. And now, everybody out there who is alive and of, you know, reasonable age, even like 5 years old and older, knows where they were the day that John F. Kennedy was assassinated. I'm talking about six-year-olds in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I'm talking about, you know, nine-year-olds in you know, East Oaxaca, Michigan. I'm talking about everybody. Well, let's read a little segment here from Bernard Fencerwald and the Committee to Assassinate Investigations, Coincidence or Conspiracy, which we quoted from earlier tonight, and let's find out about somebody who doesn't seem to remember where he was when John F. Kennedy was assassinated. Reading from Coincidence or Conspiracy. Richard Nixon, the defeated Republican presidential candidate of 1960, flew to Dallas on November 20th, 1963. Nixon was then working as an attorney for the Pepsi-Cola company and was in Dallas to attend a carbonated bottlers convention. Nixon remained in Dallas for 2 days, leaving the city about 3 hours before President Kennedy was shot to death on November 22nd. In an interview with political reporter Jules Whitcover in early 1967, Nixon told of his November 1963 trip to Dallas and his reaction to the Kennedy assassination. Quote, "I was in a taxi cab when I got the news." This is Richard Nixon speaking. "I was in a taxi cab when I got the news. I had been in Dallas attending a meeting. I flew back to New York the next morning. It must have happened just as my plane was landing. My cab was stopped for a light in Queens, and a guy ran over and said, 'Have you got a radio? The president's been wounded.' I thought, oh my God, it must have been one of the nuts. A half hour later, I got to my apartment, and the doorman told me he was dead. I called J. Edgar Hoover and asked him, 'What happened? Was it one of the nuts?' Hoover said, 'No, it was a communist.'" Going on. However, just 3 months after the assassination, Richard Nixon told the FBI another version of his trip to Dallas when he and his secretary, Rosemary Woods, were contacted by the FBI during the Warren investigation because Marina Oswald alleged that Lee had also thought about killing Nixon sometime in the spring of 1963. The Warren Commission was seeking to determine if Nixon had ever actually been in Texas during that period. During his FBI interview on February 28, 1964, Nixon inaccurately stated that he left Dallas on November 20th, rather than on November 22nd. An FBI report contained in the Warren Commission exhibit 1973 states the following. On February 28, 1964, the Honorable Richard M. Nixon, former Vice President of the U.S., was contacted by Assistant Director in charge of the New York office, John F. Malone, and furnished, Richard Nixon, furnished the following information. Mr. Nixon advised that the only time he was in Dallas, Texas during 1963 was 2 days prior to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy.